So now we move to look at homosexual behavior and the Hebrew Bible. So we're starting back pre-Christian Jewish statements about it, and I'm giving you the lot, right? There's no discussion in the Hebrew Bible of homosexuality as a physiological, psychological, sexual preference or tendency. There's no discussion ever about it. There's very little on the subject of homosexual behaviour. There's the terrible story of Sodom in Genesis chapter 10, which accounts for our word sodomy, and you know that story, and it's a dreadful story. The people who wrote it, the Bible, it's in the Bible, all right, but basically the two men were guests of Lot. And the men outside were demanding the boys to have fun with sexually. And eventually, what the chap inside was, he gave them his daughters. He kept them in, because that was dreadful, inhospitality, but he had to give them someone, so he gave them the daughters. What does that tell you about the mentality of the author and the culture? Now, it was about inhospitality and rape. That's what it's against. There's an even worse story in Judges chapter 19 of the Levite, which also involves the condemnation of rape. It's not bedtime reading. It's a dreadful story, betraying a mentality in the author of Judges chapter 19 and the community for which he's writing, which clearly see males as far, far, far more important than females. And that's been in most cultures most of history. We've got to work hard against it, because it's still in some cultures in our modern world, and it's still in other places that you've already noted earlier, and we've got to absolutely oppose it with all our might and main. But it won't be easy to do, because we're dealing with subconscious assumptions here that are very long, with a long history. And both these stories demonstrate an assumption of male superiority and a disgusting denigration of women. And if they read these stories in the church as the first reading, and it's from the Bible, so it's true, you know what I mean? Don't say thanks be to God at the end, or I'll go for your jugular. Because nothing thanks be to God about the stories at all. Okay, that's enough said. There's also, in the Old Testament scriptures, there's a proscription against cult prostitution in the book of Deuteronomy, and there's the following law which occurs twice in the book of Leviticus. And here are the two texts. One, you shall not lie with a male. And I've got the Greek there for reasons of arsen, which is male, koite means lie. You shall not lie with a male. As with a woman, it is an abomination. You'd think that's clear enough. Leviticus 18:22. Repeated in Leviticus 20:13. If a man lies with a male, same Greek terms, as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. Let's examine that. There are the two texts again in front of you. Now, the fact that both these laws are so general has led some to assume that they were intended to condemn any and every form of homosexual behaviour. However, that's an assumption. Don't presume that. No context is given for the regulations. There's nothing before them, nothing after them, no explanation, no alerting to the context. So we still have to ask, what on earth were they condemning? There's no discussion of the issues involved. They may have intended to condemn those two statements, every and any expression of homosexuality. It's quite possible that's what they had in mind. But they may have been directing their condemnation against the kind of public, flagrant male prostitution that they observed in the Greek world, which came to them as a shock. When the Greeks came in the late 4th century and the game, Greek games, and the nakedness and all that, and wrestling and the whole thing, which was horrific to a Jew in their culture. So they may have been objecting to what they saw. They may never have thought about a male with another male delicately and privately having sexual relationships somewhere. It may not have entered their heads. They may also have been motivated by a concern, which was there at the time, not to waste male semen, because they had a wrong biological idea, which continued on for a long time, I have to tell you, that human life was in the male semen. That's why they call it a seed. It's the seed of life. I know it's not. You know it's not. We know that the male semen isn't life like a seed from a tree, which is life, drops into the soil, and the soil nurtures it till it becomes a tree. We know that. That's not what happens in male-female relationships. I'm not giving you a sex class, but, you know. So the semen, the gamete, has to meet a female gamete, and only when they together do they become the seed of life. So they didn't know that. Of course they didn't know it. So to waste male seed is to waste life. It's like an abortion. Do you get me? Spilling seed outside the vagina is life is being ditched. It's not life being ditched. It is a male semen gamete being ditched, but different thing. Okay. So they had that misunderstanding also. So that may have been one of their concerns in all this. The word, now let's look at, the text said, I'll go back, as with a woman, it is an abomination. See the word abomination there twice? Sounds pretty strong, and it is strong. It means God abhors such behaviour. But can I just inform you a little bit? There's the Hebrew word, to'eba, if you want it. That word abomination occurs 116 times in the Hebrew Bible. Mostly it refers to idolatry. But the offering of defective sacrifices is also referred to as an abomination. If you offer a lamb that's not pure, that's an abomination to God. Using false weights when you're selling things in the shop is called an abomination in Deuteronomy and Proverbs. Ezekiel includes admitting foreigners into the sanctuary as an abomination. Isaiah chapter 40, first verses, the disciples of Isaiah have God say they're wrong. Your sacrifices are accepted on my altar because my temple is a house of prayer for all the peoples. The Bible is full of argument. If you take one statement out like that and say that's what God said, well, take it easy. There's another statement over here that's in discussion with it. They're searching for the truth too. They're debating it. They're looking at different values, and that's how it ought to be. It's a much more scientific process than we are led to believe. I heard something even last night that was a good program, and it was a man saying the trouble, you know, with science is exploratory and it's continually, and he said religion's not like that. Religion must be like that. We haven't got a sacred book that we're locked into. Some religions have, but Christianity doesn't, except the fundamentalists, and they're a pain because they're missing the whole point of it. The Bible is a reflection on Jesus in the New Testament. And it, of course we've got to keep looking at it and renewing it and doing what I'm trying to do now. See, what did they mean in that context? It's not a... You see what I'm saying? It's not a fixed statement of truth, abstract. It's a real statement of truth in a context that needs to be studied, defined, more knowledge should come in and reapplied, etc., etc. So, Ezekiel's... Now, he calls that an abomination. Proverbs speaks of scoffing as an abomination. Proverbs 6:16-19 is an interesting text. I'll just read it for you and then leave it. There are six things that Yahweh hates, seven that are a to'eba, abomination. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that hurry to run to evil, and a lying witness who testifies falsely. They're all true statements, but I'm just trying to make you look at the word abomination with a bit more broader... I can't think of the word from a camera, broader perspective. Okay. What emerges in the discussions of these texts among the rabbis and in the writings of Jews living in the Greek world is a strong disgust for male prostitution. And good on them for having such a strong disgust for it. Something that is condemned by the Greek and Roman moralists as well. These are good men. The Greek and, you know, most of them would be good. And they're philosophers and they're saying, no, the male prostitution is an abhorrent thing. The rabbis go further than the Greek moralists in condemning the kind of pederasty encouraged in the Gentile world. They found adult males with boys as part of the system abhorrent. And they should have too. If this is what the author of Leviticus were condemning, we better be careful not to use their words to apply to other homosexual actions that may not have been part of their thinking. That concludes my study of the Hebrew Bible. It's very general. I haven't said a lot. But I hope all I've helped you do is take caution when you quote those two little brief statements out of Leviticus without context and think you know what they were condemning. Is my main point coming across? They may have been making a general condemnation. They may have been making a general condemnation out of ignorance. They may have been making a more specific statement about what they were experiencing in the public arena from the Greek world, which was coming in as a foreign world, and that's what they saw. They saw the worst of it, and they were condemning it. So that's all I'm saying, but you can't go further than that. So it needs care for that, and it's time you took a break. So we now move to look at St. Paul now and what he says in the New Testament about homosexual behaviour. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9, and this is all he says in that text, it's the whole verse, male prostitutes, and the Greek is malakoi, we met that word a bit earlier, and sodomites, and that is a word that comes from the book of Leviticus, turning the verb and noun into a verb, arsenokoitai, will not inherit the kingdom of God. Very clear statement. Male prostitutes and sodomites will not inherit the kingdom of God. According to the most obvious reading of the text, Paul is repeating what is commonly said by Jewish writers, and to a lesser extent also by Stoic and other Greek and Roman moralists of his day. He's speaking against the behaviour of those young men, malakoi, soft, effeminate, whatever, quite obvious in cities like Corinth, who dressed themselves up and offered themselves for money for the sexual gratification of other males. He's also, that's in the malakoi, he's also condemning those who take advantage of them. The word arsenokoitai is not found in the Greek moralists. It seems to have its origin in Jewish circles and to derive from the Leviticus texts already quoted. Since Paul simply lists these sins here, we should assume that he's repeating common Jewish condemnations of male prostitution and pederasty. We would need more evidence to justify extending Paul's meaning to condemn outright all homosexual behaviour. If we use those texts for such a condemnation, we need to know that we're making an assumption. In another letter, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10, we read, among those who, he's got a whole list of those who behave in ways that he says that are against sound teaching, and he includes these three, fornicators, sodomites, and slave traders. What does he mean? We've got to go back to the Greek, because he wrote in Greek, and then we've got to find what the Greek word meant at the time. Fornicators translates the Greek pornoi, the primary meaning of which is male prostitutes. Porne is a female prostitute, pornos is a male prostitute, and the plural of pornos is pornoi, for those of you who know Greek. Sodomites translates the Greek arsenokoitai, which we've already met, which could be referring to those who pay for the sexual services of the prostitutes. Slave traders translates the Greek andropodistia. Paul may be referring to those who take slave boys into brothels for purposes of prostitution. So once again, Paul may be condemning obvious public sexually aberrant behaviour that is going on in the Greek cities which he visited, and as a Jew and a Christian Jew, he found abhorrent. That might be what he's condemning in that text. Paul's words to Timothy cannot safely be used to condemn other forms of homosexual behaviour. Romans 1:25-27. I'm stressing this because there are still people around who love to quote Paul and the New Testament for their own moral agenda, and most of it is probably good. But it's a misuse of the Bible that's abhorrent. So you need to know that and to check it. Romans 1:25-27 reads, "Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural. And in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error." That's the most lengthy, careful statement we find anywhere in the Bible in this matter. This text is notable for two reasons. Firstly, it's one of only a handful of texts from the time that even mention female homosexual behaviour. There's about three or four extant texts in the whole of the ancient world that talk about it. This is one of them. Secondly, Paul uses the expression unnatural, paraphusin, used by Plato against those who allowed their affection for young men to descend into sexual gratification, and used by a number of Greek moralists in their condemnation of male homosexual gratification that was separated from real affection, and where the younger man was treated as a commodity for sale. It's possible that Paul is expressing the traditional Jewish opposition to male prostitution and is extending his words to include women to demonstrate the universal degradation from which human beings need redemption. And that's the point of the first three chapters of the letter to the Romans. We all need, Jew and Gentile, male and female, our lives all need to be redeemed by the love of Jesus. That's the key point he's making. And this would fit that, excuse me, coughing. In the light of other Jewish writings, it's likely that Paul intends to include the Gentile practice of pederasty, adult male and boy. Beyond that, we are in the area of conjecture. Our conclusion, my conclusion, is that these three texts from Paul cannot be used to close the discussion about homosexual behaviour, as some are wont to do. At the same time, we should observe that Paul has more to offer to the discussion on homosexual behavior than these three statements. Everything he says about love, everything he says about sensitivity, everything he says about mutuality and the sacred nature of sex is relevant to our discussion, as it is relevant to the discussion about heterosexual behavior. So that's all I want to say about Paul, because that's all he says of it, and that's the best I can offer you from whatever I know about it. And now I want to go on to some concluding comments. Jack Dominion, I quoted him last week, he's an English psychiatrist who writes excellently on all matters to do with sexuality. He has a book called The Growth of Love and Sex, which he published in 1982, and he talks there about adolescent ambiguity. Not all young people who experience attraction towards their own sex will necessarily finish as exclusive homosexuals. Everybody knows that adolescents may have crushes on members of their own sex at school or afterwards, which are ephemeral, passing, and not persistent. Indeed, some experts maintain that no permanent orientation is established until the middle 20s. And so great care should be taken not to affix a label too early. If, on the other hand, the tendency is there clearly in interest, attraction, dreams, and unconscious orientation, denial of the obvious is purposeless. Life has to be lived fully in that style. If you're a homosexual, it's the only way you can live a sexual life. That's my bit. I'm sorry, I'm just adding there. And now a comment. Accurate diagnosis and expert counselling are important. Important, too, are acceptance, respect, empathy, clarity, chastity, modesty, and love. That is the way that all of us should treat each other, whatever our sexual orientation, and it doesn't change. There's a lot in those words, aren't there? And it's not easy to do that in a culture that is driven by the majority, which all cultures are. So we have to do a lot of soul searching to come to be able to accept, respect, have empathy for, be clear and chaste and modest and loving to our brothers and sisters who have a different sexual orientation than we have. If homosexual behaviour, like heterosexual behaviour, can be pathological. It can involve fear of the opposite sex, fear of adult responsibility, need to defy authority, attempt to cope with hatred of members of one sexual group, competitiveness, flight from reality, escape into bodily stimulation, violence and promiscuity. There's a lot in that paragraph too, but that's... And for a young man, often, a friend... I mean, some of the best friendships in history have been male and male and female and female, and they continue through life. It's normal. And I think if I was a woman, I'd want to be talking to a woman. The men are such complicated creatures, aren't we? And if I was a bloke, and I am a bloke... Oh, God, a friendly conversation with another bloke leaves conversations with women for dead, I have to tell you. Because it's so uncomplicated and straightforward and kind of friendly, and you don't get into these, you don't like the spider and the web and the fly, and it's all very tricky. So speaking now, I mean, we're tricky people, and sexual attraction between male and female, I'm told, is a pretty, you know, you're walking on a tightrope. So that's life. So is it any surprise that men gather together at all the parties in one end of the room and the women are at the other end of the room? Pretty normal behaviour. some cultures have got it locked in behaviour. Well, so there, because there's a lot of stuff in there: competitiveness, fear, escape. Fear of the feminine is one of the big things in psychology of the male, and there's probably an equivalent from the female's point of view. But these are realities that we're all. And to dare to love a woman and then to say, I love you, and to marry her and have children with her and stay with her for the rest of their life, that's canonisation material just to start. You know, that's just amazing. So, because it's big stuff we're talking about. It's massive, isn't it? As in heterosexual relationships, so in homosexual relationships, there are levels of commitment. There's non-relational sex in homosexual behaviour, as in heterosexual behaviour, which includes depersonal sex, consumer sex, exploitation, eroticism, exhibitionism. All these things happen in both camps. There is relational sex, but without commitment, in which are found values of warmth, sensitivity, openness, and mutual respect. There's relational sex with commitment, in which people experience true communion, male with male, female with female. Jack Dominion writes in the same book, "What is absolutely clear is that relationship is better than isolation and loneliness. Permanent commitment is better than transient exchanges, and faithfulness is better than promiscuity." We'd all agree with that, but it's important to say. So that if a person is in a isolated, non-permanent, promiscuous homosexual relationship, wouldn't it be wonderful if they found someone that they could be in a permanent, committed and faithful relationship? It mightn't be the end of the journey, I don't know, but isn't that better? And wouldn't we want to help that happen? Or do we just... Yeah. Now, this last point is expressed also in a statement from the Catholic Bishops of England, Wales, referred to earlier, and this is what they wrote. "A specially delicate situation arises when homosexual persons are convinced that, although they accept that homosexual acts in themselves cannot be justified," they might go that far, "it's found impossible in practice to lead a celibate life. They might then claim that the choice remains between a stable union in which there's a necessary and inevitable physical relationship and an obviously distasteful, promiscuous way of life." That might be where they are. "Such persons," say the bishops, "argue that in their particular case the stability of the union outweighs the disorder of the homosexual acts that take place within it. They would argue that the goodness or badness of an act can only be judged morally in practice when consideration has been given to intention and circumstances." So they're staying well within the Catholic teaching of the Catechism, the bishops are, but they're giving a very pastoral context within which to live it. Father Jan Visser, who was the co-author of the 1975 Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith document on Declaration on Certain Questions Concerning Sexual Ethics. That's a document that came out of that congregation. And the co-author of it wrote the following. "When one is dealing with people who are so predominantly homosexual that they will be in serious personal and perhaps social trouble unless they attain a steady partnership within their homosexual lives, one can recommend them to seek such a partnership, and one accepts this relationship as the best they can do in their present circumstances." Some would go further than that, but he's gone a fair way there. A few more comments. Conscience. I'd like to refer you back to an earlier chapter, an earlier discussion we had on conscience, and you can find that on the web if you want to do it. We did it a long time ago. Suffice here to quote Pope John Paul II in his Crossing the Threshold of Hope. And he writes, that was 1994, he writes, "If a person is admonished by his or her own conscience, even an erroneous conscience, but one whose voice appears to him as unquestionable, he or she must always listen to it. What is not permissible is that people culpably indulge in error without trying to reach the truth." That's a pretty good statement on conscience. If we're trying to reach the truth, and in that effort a person has a conscientious understanding that this is appropriate behaviour, they follow it without guilt. Thank you. When it comes to presentation of the Church's teaching in this complex area, we will do well to recall the following from the Washington State Catholic Conference, called The Prejudice Against Homosexuals and the Ministry of the Church, 1983. The statement reads, "The Church can combat the evil of prejudice against homosexuals by strongly proclaiming the gross evil of prejudicial attitudes and conduct towards lesbians and gays, by fostering legislation to remove systematic prejudice, by making efforts to purify of all prejudice the manner in which it conveys its moral teaching on homosexuality, by encouraging empirical research on homosexuality." You see, it's actually a modern enough problem. We didn't have the psychological penetration that we've got today in understanding. So we've got to take on board all science. It's wonderful when it's honest, and it isn't always honest, as you know, but it's a wonderful tool, isn't it? And we've hundreds of years of advance have happened in the last couple of hundred years in the scientific world. So let's encourage as much honest exploration of all these matters to do with sexuality as every other matter. And we're not afraid of the truth, for God's sake. And we bring to the truth a love, an understanding from Jesus, a wonderful Christian attitude. But we're learning in all these fields in the modern world things that Paul never dreamed of, nor did the authors of the book of Leviticus. I was supposed to be quoting someone, wasn't I? The Washington State Conference. Well, the last few sentences weren't a quote, so how you work that out, I don't know. I'll go back again. "The Church can combat the evil of prejudice against homosexuals by strongly proclaiming the gross evil of prejudicial attitudes and conduct towards lesbians and gays." How do we do that? "Fostering legislation to remove systemic prejudice, making efforts to purify of all prejudice the manner in which it conveys its moral teaching on homosexuality, encouraging empirical research on homosexuality and the ways to combat prejudice against lesbians and gays, and by fostering ongoing theological research and criticism," critical understanding that means, "with regard to its own theological tradition on homosexuality, none of which is infallibly taught." Good old American bishops. So, I'm drawing to a close. While we work for greater clarity, and we're working for it, we must guard against so overrating sex that ordinary, healthy, pleasure-loving and sexually attractive people are made to feel inadequate. Everybody, I bet, in this room and every room I've ever been in who've seen some films would wonder why their sexual life is not nearly as enchanting, exciting, over the moon and wonderful as what they see on the celluloid. Because it isn't. It's a bloody lie going on there. Good luck. So, but we don't feel inadequate. It's you, me. Let us not forget that genital sex does not fill our existential loneliness. Let us also encourage chastity, service, love-giving. That's what the kids want to learn about. They're being told that the answer to all their dreams is in sexual gratification and in binge drinking and in being blown out of this world or in whatever else is going on. It's all lies. We know it's lies. Everybody knows it's lies. Everyone who's doing it knows it's a lie. And what they're trying to find is who they are individually inside, very beautiful young men and young women, not helped by all this extraneous losing of control. That's what we know. So all of us have to do it together, to just see their beauty, encourage their beauty and help them find better ways. Some of my generation, perhaps most of my generation, I don't know, we had a much easier time of it because we had home training. We didn't have all these explosive possibilities around. I did what my mother told me, didn't you? And so it was a different world. And they have all this colossal information coming in that excites them. People are always using that word with me. Did you find going to Rome exciting? And I say no, because exciting is, might sound drab, but I don't recall being excited for years about anything. Because who wants to be excited? I'd rather be peaceful and in touch and loving, hopefully, and... But, well, that's me. But anyhow, maybe it's you too. So, chastity is a beautiful virtue to train the children in. Hard, because every other girl or boy is dressing unchastely. So you parents have got a big job, unless you join a community and the community reinforces your help. Service, love-giving. Kids love... I've just finished reading that book on Chris Riley called Something in Kind Heart in Mean Street, I think it's called, his work with kids. And, some of them have just come from such dreadful situations and turned into such wonderful young adults, basically because they were needed and they helped other people, including other kids. Took them to East Timor and they came back excited, like, because they found they had something to give. Whereas they didn't know they had, they're running here. So, anyhow. We must be careful not to be hasty in defining a person as being homosexual. Or heterosexual, for that matter. We must avoid defining people solely according to their sexual orientation. I'm saying we must do all these things. Don't take any notice of me, but make sense of it yourself. We should reject false stereotypes prevalent among the dominant and often unthinking heterosexual majority. There's a dark side to being an Australian that's very, very dark. Prejudices, I love telling people Jesus had a Eastern European appearance. Eastern, what is it? Is that the word they use about the East European? Middle Eastern appearance. Jesus had one of those. Okay. And I conclude with this. We should be careful not to add to anyone's insecurity by oppression or force others into neurosis by rejection. We are to accept people as they are and help everyone find the next step of love in their life, their real life, the next step of love. And I finished with a book written by a South Australian priest who has a lovely book on this whole issue of homosexuality called This Remarkable Gift, talking about homosexuality. And it is a remarkable gift. You must know, I know, homosexual men. I do know some homosexual women, but not well, so I'll talk about men. I know some homosexual men who are just such beautiful, caring human beings, and that they've got a remarkable gift for empathy, care. That's why they often get into the artistic and the hospitality areas, and they do it so well, and it's a remarkable gift, but a remarkable gift that often has gone into very hurtful ways because of rejection by church and state and majority of us. So what a failure it would be for me and for you not to recognize homosexuality, rare as it is, and the statistics are bumped up by gays and lesbians. They're a bit unreal, I think. But this homosexual minority in our community, I just think it would be marvellous if we recognised their remarkable gift and brought it out. They'd be great lovers of the world and of community and of the arts. And why wouldn't we accept their remarkable gift among us? And then they have to work out who else can do it away, if they have the gift of celibacy as well, which is obviously possible and probably fairly common, they could become marvellous nurses and carers and priests and whatever, nuns and brothers teaching. And if they haven't got the gift of celibacy, they'd have to work out how best to love. And I think it should be left to them to work it out. What I'm doing here. Another one.